And welcome back to What China Wants with me, Sam Olson, and Stuart Patterson, of course. So the Evenstar Institute, which What China Wants is a part of, is dedicated to measuring and understanding national influence, particularly that of China. And an incredibly important part of national influence comes from a country's ability to control and dominate the media. We're lucky today to be joined by Josh Kalancic, the author of a really good new book on China's international media activities, Beijing's Global Media Offensive, China's Uneven Campaign to Influence Asia and the World. And Josh is a senior fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations, an American think tank. Welcome, Josh. It's really good to have you on the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, really liked your book. It was incredibly interesting. One of the most sort of thought-provoking parts of it was that you split media influence into two different camps, soft power and sharp power. Can you explain the difference?
Well, soft power was originally a concept created by Joe Nye, a famous political theorist. But the idea is you use a variety of tools, which could be cultural, media, etc. And they don't. Most of these tools actually don't come from the state. They come from actors not related to the state, the NBA, Hollywood, etc. But the state also can exert soft power through its state media outlets, through its cultural diplomacy programming. The U.S. did this very extensively in the Cold War, etc. But all the things that go together to creating a favorable or unfavorable public image of a country in another country. And these things are done in an open and transparent way. And in theory, if you have a favorable public image in another country, there's no direct link, but it probably helps convince policymakers to take actions in your favor if the public is genuinely and largely supportive of that other country. Britain would be a perfect example. Britain's hard power and economic power over the last 50 years has declined fairly measurably. But at the same time, Britain's soft power, its ability to have massive influence culturally on the globe through institutions like the monarchy and the BBC, the television industry, et cetera, the Premier League, is actually still quite enormous. Sharp power is a kind of newer concept. And what it means is it's not hard power where you're actually necessarily threatening someone or with military or economic coercion or actually invading them or attacking them, but you're using means, which can include media and information, to wield power within societies more covertly, often with the intent of corroding that society rather than just creating warm public image. And in some occasions, like we've seen in Australia, I talk about in the book, and in other places, quite corruptly in terms of ways in which the sharp power involves money exchanging hands in somewhat nefarious ways.
Brilliant. So if we just come to China and the media then, most of our listeners will have stumbled across the China Daily, probably by accident, and they probably don't read it avidly. That's sort of one example of China's media outreach. But there are lots of them, aren't there? And your point about a lot of soft power not coming from the state, in the case of China, presumably the linkage between the party state and the media is pretty total, isn't it?
Yes, that's correct. I mean, China has the capacity to have significant reserves of soft power that's not linked to the state. And in fact, some of that was beginning to bubble up in the 2000s with the Beijing Olympics, which generally went well. They had, you know, world-class artists and painters. They have actually quite a strong cultural influence. This is probably not an area that we focus on, but they have a quite strong influence in fashion and makeup culturally, particularly for younger men and women. And at that time, in the 2000s and in the 90s, they also had more of an influence culturally in some other areas as well, art, film, etc. But they've basically killed that now. So that's basically gone because their famous artists are in exile. The most famous is in exile. And writers and people who are publishing interesting things are in exile or in jail. And the television shows that they had started to make popular having killed by Xi Jinping and mostly replaced by South Korea, actually. But yes, so most of China's media soft power has to thus come from the state. All of it, basically. Since the few Chinese media outlets that are even semi-independent anymore are only producing within the country and in Chinese. So we're talking about China Global Television Network, which was their rebranded CCTV International, into which they've poured huge sums of money over the last 10 years, staggering sums. I don't have an exact figure. At one point, it was $6.8 billion. Some people say $15 billion since 2010. They opened bureaus in London, Nairobi, Washington, and about 25 other major cities, hired tons of local journalists, including in the UK, and many quality local journalists. A second one is China Radio International, which is their international radio station. And a third one I talk about at length is Xinhua. They have several state news agencies, but let's not get too technical. That's the main state news agency that deals with international issues.
So if we were to try and measure the effectiveness of China's media reach internationally, what would be the sort of narratives that spring to your mind as being the best examples of how Chinese media has successfully sort of twisted or shaped a narrative recently, and therefore this investment in global media reach has started to pay dividends for them?
Mostly, I argue in the book that China's massive investment has not paid dividends for them. That's thus the subtitle, that they've set on fire a huge amount of cash on CGTN and CRI with little result. That those stations, and I have Gallup polling from a huge number of countries showing the incredibly minimal reach. That's not to say even countries have actually just outright banned them, like Australia and the UK have banned CGTN. So actually, mostly I've found that of the three big ones, they have wasted their money so far. Most of the quality foreign journalists, and that includes, when I say foreign journalists, maybe people come to mind, they think journalists in London, but most of those people were really good journalists, like in Africa and Southeast Asia, people who were doing groundbreaking work. They even hired people who hired people in Africa whose groundbreaking work was exposing Chinese environmental abuses. So they're fairly open-minded about who they were hiring. Most of those people have left in the last 5 years because the environment at those outlets, though never totally free, as China has become more one-man rule and as Xi has become even more powerful, the attitude has become more turgid and much more authoritarian. And most of those journalists have left, not to mention some of those countries have imposed laws that where if you work for a state media outlet, you have to register as a foreign agent like the United States, and journalists don't want to do that. Xinhua, however, has had significant success because they've signed content sharing agreements with a lot of other countries. And so they are being folded into the local media in local languages in many places without people really realizing that the content comes from Xinhua, because most readers don't pay any attention to the byline or tagline of where the content comes from, unless it comes from some famous, famous columnist. So a good example would be this. I believe from Sam that you have done research on this, but a lot of very prominent Thai media outlets, and Thailand is a country I know best, have signed content sharing agreements with Xinhua, including the most prominent group, the Matichong Group, which is the New York Times group. There isn't a British example because the British press is so, there's no one. I mean, I'm sure conservatives and labor people would say there is one or whatever, but there isn't really like the New York Times. Matichong Group is like the New York Times of Thailand. They produce the best political weekly. They produce the best coverage. You're supposed to think, if you pick up something produced by the Matichong Group, it's good journalism. And they have signed an agreement and are increasingly used quite a lot of Xinhua copy without either labeled it as agencies or often not labeling it at all. And so Chinese propaganda, essentially, because Xinhua is kind of a propaganda agency, is being filtered into quality Thai media without these readers. And Matichong is read by the elite, like, you know, everyone who's everyone in Bangkok without them knowing it. So that would be an example of very good use of China's money.
So defenders of China would say that there are other state agencies around the world. And what is the difference between what Xinhua is doing and, for example, Agence France-Presse? Because surely these agencies belong to a certain country and they're just folding in the news from their country's point of view. So it's just China trying to play the game that everyone else is playing. What would you say to that?
All right, well, two things. When we're talking about agencies that are not AFP or the BBC, when we're talking about the biggest news agencies, AP, Reuters, and Bloomberg, those are private entities that are not owned by the state anyway. They have complete editorial independence. But AFP, which actually worked for, and the BBC, also have charters of editorial independence. And so, like, it was a long time ago when I worked for AFP, but and I worked in Bangkok, but we would get all the news from Paris overnight. And AFP would be running stories from Paris, like Chirac's government polling at 15%. Chirac, surely a sure bet not to run for re-election. You know, protesters in the street demand Chirac's head. Like, you know, where, and the BBC, I mean, the BBC runs stories that are critical of the UK all the time, or they just run stories. They're not necessarily designed to be critical. The AFP wasn't going out there saying, we want to get Jacques Chirac. They were just reporting that, you know, Jacques Chirac at that time was really unpopular and people were out in the street calling for his head. I don't want to defend Martin Bashir's editorial methods, but on the BBC literally ran an interview with the Princess of Wales in which she took down the entire royal family. I mean, that, yes, the royal family is just the head of state, not the head of government, but Xinhua would never do anything like that. They would never produce anything like that because they enjoy no editorial independence at all. To think of an idea like that on Xinhua is completely unfathomable.
So we've spoken a lot about China's influence or lack of influence in the normal media channels, but there's also quite a few accusations, especially in the West and in Europe and North America, about China's penchant for disinformation. That came particularly to light in COVID. But also, I think that you've spoken, written a lot about how disinformation has been used in a Taiwanese setting.
Sure. The disinformation comes less from the state media, but rather from individual actors and the networks of them spreading disinformation. Yeah, in the 2020-2021 presidential election in Taiwan, there was two candidates, incumbent from the Democratic Progressive Party, Tsai Ing-wen, who is reviled by Beijing. She has not called for independence, but the DPP has historically been near the margins of looking for independence and very, very hawkish in their China policy in many ways. And the candidate of the Kuomintang, Han Kuo-yu, the KMT, has been historically more pro-China, shall we say. It's a very basic. And Han rose from a very quickly to become the KMT's presidential candidate. He himself had some good qualities that led to that, like he was kind of a populist that was in at that time. But also, there was an enormous amount of sort of disinformation and bots type activity propelling his campaign, as well as outlets in Taiwan, traditional media outlets, that have very, very strong links to Beijing. I don't want to say the name on a UK podcast. I would say it on an American podcast, but other UK news outlets which produce extensive reports on this major Taiwanese media company's links to Beijing and how they were getting actual, according to this prominent British financial media outlet, how they were getting direct reports from China's Taiwanese affairs minister of what to cover, they were then sued for libel. And the laws of that in the UK are strikingly different than in the US. So China kept ramping up both the traditional and this disinformation campaign to support their KMT candidate. But it backfired completely for three reasons. One, Taiwan actually has a pretty robust anti-disinformation armor. due to citizens being inundated with Chinese disinformation long before anyone started talking about this in Britain or whatever. They have some quality, good local independent media outlets reporting on it. There is a good knowledge of it. And it also made Hankou look like a tool of Beijing, which you don't want to look like. And then that combined with around the same time, Beijing decided to destroy all the freedoms in Hong Kong. Tsai Ing-wen just jumped on this, was roundly reelected. And that is certainly not what China wanted.
So, Josh, that's a great example of the disinformation campaign backfiring. But in part, that's down to, as you put it, Taiwan's robust armor. Presumably, in a lot of the global south, and including parts of Southeast Asia, there simply isn't that kind of societal resilience to disinformation campaigns. Can you point to any areas where China has actually been successful in influencing political outcomes through disinformation?
I don't think China has yet become that successful in influencing political outcomes through disinformation, because their disinformation is still quite unsophisticated as compared to Russia's, where Russia is very good at taking organic divides within us, the society, like divides in the U.S. over class and race, or divides in France over issues related to class and race, or divides in the U.K., and building on those organic, actual problems and using disinformation to augment them. And China has not yet done so well at that, although they are getting better at it. I think they have had some effect, probably, in using disinformation, that they had some positive effect in using their disinformation to help Marcos Jr. in the Philippines. There's some evidence of that. But at the same time, it's hard to tell, because Marcos Jr. himself was swamping Filipinos with a fusillade of his own disinformation. So I think the die is still out, and that actually one of the things I argue in the book is that China's disinformation tactics still lag behind Russia's, at least Russia pre-Ukraine war, when they were a little bit less distracted.
And so, Josh, if there's a takeaway for policymakers, and let's treat them separately, policymakers in the sort of developed, free-leaning world, and policymakers in the developing world, there's a takeaway from your book as to how they should be pushing back against China's global media offensive. What is it? What is the takeaway? What's the policy prescription?
Well, I think they need to separate between what works and what doesn't right now. And that means not worrying so much about some of the big state media outlets, except Xinhua. And they need to really think about Xinhua and how Xinhua operates. And in big countries where news editors still have money, they should think twice about signing agreements with Xinhua. You know, major Italian and German publications and newswires have signed content sharing deals with Xinhua. Is that necessary, etc.? They should spend money on digital literacy programs. They have one at my children's school, but it's a fancy private school. But I know private school doesn't mean the same thing in the U.S., but it's a private school. And everyone should have extensive digital literacy training. There's good models of it from Finland and Taiwan. Policymakers should think that China is going to adapt, that China is, while a one-party state, is still adaptable, and that China's disinformation, state media apparatus, its use of, we didn't even get to this, but trying to use its control of information pipes like Chinese satellite TV and et cetera, companies getting greater access to the market in developing places, is going to become a tool of spreading Chinese influence, that these are all going to get better in the future. And fourth, we didn't talk about this at all, but there need to be really hard, strict, in developed countries, very significant policies that, one, prohibit foreign interference of any type in elections, and two, treat the media and communication sector as an area where foreign investors should be subject to the same scrutiny. And that's not just Chinese, but any foreign investors, as they would be if they invested in a sector that traditionally had security capabilities. So in the past, in the U.S., if someone wanted to invest in a chips or steel sector that could have potential ramifications that can be built into a missile, or et cetera, that investment by a foreigner would be subject to special scrutiny. Now the U.S. is extending that to media and communications. I believe that Australia that's the wave of the future, that the U.K., Europe, and Canada, and virtually every other developed democracy will do the same. For developing countries, you know, it's harder. They don't have the same amount of money. I think that one thing that developing countries should do, and that all countries should do, is simply strengthen the quality of democracy as an ability to deliver effective governance. One of the reasons why China has been able to have any success with this, and also in promoting their model, is democracy hasn't had a great 15 years. So until zero COVID, China looked good by comparison. Developing countries can promote digital literacy too. There's good digital literacy programs in some developing countries. Developing countries, while maybe not being able to not use Xinhua or others, they should strengthen their independent media, particularly developing countries that are democracies. And the big aid agencies like DFID and USAID and others should realize that spending money on independent media in developing countries brings back massive rewards, multiple fold. So that's another area. And then finally, I think in developing countries, there needs to be a recognition, and this is true in developed countries too, that just to think twice about, in terms of media, China offers a massive number of training programs, primarily for journalists from developing countries. There's nothing necessarily wrong with that. I mean, the U.S. does that too, et cetera. But to go into that with open eyes, thinking about what you are and aren't allowed to see. And while you're on the program, they're probably not going to arrest reporters from Kenya that they've wooed to come, you know, ask, push, et cetera, ask to go to places that, the Chinese government doesn't want you to go. When you're on tours, ask questions, push, et cetera, et cetera. Ask to go to Xinjiang. I mean, the worst they can say is no, they're not going to arrest the best reporter at Kenya's business newspaper after they've invited him on a lavish trip to China, et cetera.
Josh, thanks very much indeed. And for our listeners who want to learn more about it, Joshua's book, Beijing's Global Media Offensive, is published and available in the UK and around the world. Joshua, thanks very much. We've got a lot to learn about how to handle China's media offensive. And thanks for coming on What China Wants.
Thanks so much for having me.